try.
Thanks, guys.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Sean.
There's our speaker. Bastard. I want to hear Kelly. Is it too late? Oh, you forgot. It's 7:30 meeting, Kelly. It's not 8 o'clock.
I thought it was 8 o'clock. Well,
next week.
Yeah, right.
Done.
I need a meeting anyway.
You came to the wrong one. I'm going to sit.
So I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And share my experience, strength, and hope. And I'll try to do that. I was thinking about AA. And AA for me, especially here, is pretty well the family that I didn't have. This is a place you can always come back to. I didn't necessarily find that true for family, but it's absolutely true for here. And I've come back more than once, and half this room has come back more than once. I have a cunning, baffling, powerful, and patient disease that wants me, doesn't want me dead, because I'm absolutely useless to my disease dead. It wants me drunk. And it wants me causing as much chaos and damage to everybody in the world as possible. That's what my disease wants of me. And I am 44. I turned 44 on St. Patrick's Day. And so it's just after my birthday. And it was always, I had a great birthday. What a great birthday for an alcoholic. St. Patrick's Day. But because I was an alcoholic, every day is St. Patrick's Day. You know, in fact, I didn't necessarily like drinking on St. Patrick's Day because you had all the amateurs out. Once a year, everybody decides they're Irish and maybe an alcoholic. And what that means is all the bars are clogged up with these amateurs. And I can't get a drink. I felt the same way about New Year's. I didn't like going out New Year's Eve. Because, again, it's one of these amateur drinking nights where piles of normal people jam the bars and get drunk. And maybe they drink a beer or two and get silly. And these people who drink normally disgust me. I don't understand them. And that's sort of how one of those things that told me maybe I'm a little bit different than other people. I had a roommate who wasn't an alcoholic. And he didn't understand how I drank because I just, you know, if the bottle gets opened, it gets finished. And once that one's gone, there better be another one, da 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 da. Whereas he would have a beer and leave a half a beer on the table to get warm. He would waste alcohol. He'd say things like, "I'm not thirsty anymore." So I didn't understand. There are 12 steps in AA, and one of the things I've always found interesting is only the first half of the first step and the last half of the 12th step mention alcohol. So I'm sort of scientifically inclined. So I did the math. That's like 1 out of 12 steps involves alcohol. And for those of you even more mathematically inclined, that's 8.3%. So 8.3% of my problem is alcohol. That leaves a little over 91% being something else. 91% of my problem is something other than alcohol. It's right in here, right about there. It's the emotions, it's everything else. I did not set out to become an alcoholic, but I come from a nice Irish Catholic American family. where a lot of members of my family are drunks. And in my family, it was just known as the problem. So it would be, you know, Uncle Jack has the problem. My mom had the problem. You know, my oldest sister has the problem. Or had the problem. You know, I have seven kids. We've got two members and some that might show up one day and others with other problems. I don't particularly like speaking. The first time I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous was in New York City in 1979 or something. I was 17. And I'd been drinking and smoking dope, and I liked it a lot. And my mother, who was an alcoholic, had discovered Alcoholics Anonymous. And she'd gotten sober. And because she had gotten sober, she became a giant pain in the ass to me. And she told me, you know, you've got the problem. And why don't you go speak to my psychiatrist? So I went to talk to my mother's psychiatrist about my drinking and my using at 17. And the psychiatrist was a prick. And the psychiatrist said, you know, he started talking about this. First thing he does is says, you have to stop. I'm 17. He tells me I have to stop. And I said, you know, wouldn't it be okay to do this just once a week? You know, I'm being generous here. And he said something that stuck with me that I mention every time I open my mouth in front of people. He said, as long as it's not the focal point of your week. And at that moment, I was completely fucked. Because even if I drank once a decade, I know it would be the focal point of my decade. Because that, for me, was what being a drunk was like. It was the thing I looked forward to. It took care of all the problems. It became the only thing that mattered. But it didn't start out that way. But that's what happened. Because guess what? I like being drunk and I like being wasted. I really, really enjoy it. And birds fly, fish swim, and drunks drink. And my natural state is hammered off my ass. And that's it. It's that simple. For me, it's that simple. Everything else doesn't matter. And I was very good at my work, but it didn't really matter because the only thing that mattered to me was getting drunk. And it solved all the problems. I had no more discomfort. I had always felt different. I'd always been scared of people. You know, I was okay. I pick up a drink, I'm okay again. I'm all right for the first time in my life. I did really well in school. I don't think I ever felt loved at all growing up. And So I showed up at school and I started to do really well. And when I mean really well, we're talking 98-100. And so it was a lot of work because I believed that if I did a lot of work, I'd be lovable. And this stayed the same right through, you know, grade one, grade two, you know. This is pretty sick. And eventually, you know, got to high school and all of a sudden, you know, still 98-99. Lots and lots of work, because maybe I'd be lovable. And, you know, I picked up a drink, and I didn't have to work anymore. I didn't have to work at all. I was just fine. And it was magic, and that was that. I came up to Montreal to go to McGill, And I majored in drug abuse and alcoholism, and spent 3 years at McGill, failed out, and ended up at Sunday Nighters for the first time just after Christmas 1982. And at that point, I was living with a girl and making her life miserable to the extent that she was sleeping with a knife under her pillow because she was scared of what I was going to do, that I'd fly into rages. And I'll explain, just we'll give you a little picture of the apartment. The apartment had lots of postcards and maps on the walls. Every postcard covered up a fist hole, and the maps covered up like kneeing the wall and punching the giant, gigantic holes. So it wasn't such a happy time or a happy place, and I was depressed, and I was angry, and bitter, and mad, just, you know. And I hadn't quite made the connection that it's the alcohol. It was everybody else. It was her, it was this. Drinking and using solved the problems. You know, they took the pain away. They weren't, that was the only thing I looked forward to. You know, everything else was the problem. And so I showed up at Sunday night. And I was mad. I was mad as hell. And you guys greeted me really nicely, you know, shook my hand coming in. And all I wanted to do was break all your kneecaps because maybe you'd have some sort of idea of how I felt. And I saw the steps, not too sure about the first step, but the second step really got me because I was insane and I knew it. I was convinced the devil was chasing me at this point. Garbage bags were turning into people as walking around. I was insane. And I had gone to a lot of the CLSCs and doctors and stuff trying to figure out what's wrong. Except, like a lot of alcoholics, I may be crazy, but I'm not stupid. So I'm not going to tell the psychiatrists what's wrong. I know what's wrong. I'm not going to tell you what's going on in my head that I want to kill this guy or that guy or the other one, you know? Because if I tell you the truth, if I told the psychiatrist the truth about what was going on in my head, I would be I'd be off at the Douglas for a while. I'd be checked in, and I don't want to go there. So let's talk about something else. We'll talk about family. I'm not going to talk about what's really going on. So nothing got better. And early on in that first time sobriety, I was seeing a psychiatrist here at the Ready. And I started to get sober. And this guy knew who he was dealing with because he made my appointments at 8:30 in the morning. And that's just terrible. I mean, because any time after 8:30, I would be wasted. So I managed to show up miserable and sober there. And within the first 3 months, he turned to me and said, "Look, I've done everything I can do for you. You're a child of God. Go to meetings." And this is from the psychiatrist. And that was the end of that. And that's what I did. I joined 10 groups of Alcoholics Anonymous. I made coffee at as many of them as I could because I was absolutely terrified of going back to where I came from. And you guys said, "Get active." Well, go to meetings, don't drink in between the meetings. And that's what I did. And I figured it's sort of like learning Chinese. You know, if you go to your Chinese lesson once a month for an hour, well, at the end of the first year, you're not going to know too many Chinese words. Well, I was in Chinese immersion, you know, as many AA meetings as I could get to. And things got better. You know, people say, things get better. Well, they get worse first. Nobody mentions that they get worse first, you know. They get worse first. Because I had spent a long time completely numb. Like being at the dentist on Novocaine. You know, after a few months, guess what? The Novocaine starts wearing off and it starts to hurt. And hopefully by then there were people to talk to. Because all of a sudden I was discovering I had some emotions that I didn't know I'd had. One of the more interesting ones I discovered was rage. I wasn't able to identify that for a while until the girl I was living with at the time came home, and I noticed a matchbook. You know, she had a matchbook, and I, being the paranoid bastard that I was, opened the matchbook, and what's there? Some guy's phone number. So I freak out, and I start shaking. But I'm a few months sober, so I know what to do. I call my sponsor. I say, I found this phone number and I'm shaking. What is that? He said, Sean, that's rage. Oh, cool. So I learned to identify emotions. They weren't really nice or anything, but and survived these things. You know, survived these things. And survived painful shit sober. Because all of a sudden, there was no way to anesthetize the emotions that were going on. A lot of meeting help. Fast forward 8 years. When I came in here, I didn't know what I was going to do for a living. I didn't have any skills or anything particular. I was lucky that people took care of me. And I eventually found work and did really well. You know, I'm good at doing well at work. So became very successful at what I did. And around 7.5 years sober, my mother was diagnosed with lung cancer. And so we started to talk. At about 8 years sober, she died. And I didn't handle that particularly well, but I didn't realize how messed up I was, because I had stayed very active in AA for the first 5 years. After the first 5 years, life took over, less meetings, less activity. By about 8.5 years, I was pretty dry. It was like Lawrence of Arabia. You know, no exposed flames around me, please. And so Mom died, and I found myself 6 months afterwards in the company of a lady I just met that evening at her apartment, and she suggested that we smoke some Quebecois weed. When I'd gotten sober in 1982, Quebecois weed was not dangerous. I mean, you could smoke a garbage bag of Quebecois weed and nothing would happen. You know, in those 8 years, Quebec technology improved greatly. And I smoked the stuff, and all of a sudden, I'm stoned. I am not sober for the first time in 8.5 years. And that was a bad place to be. And that was the beginning of my first slip. This is why I'm saying disease is cunning, baffling, powerful, and patient. Because I didn't pick up a drink. I'd spent 8.5 years having it pounded into me, you don't pick up a drink. So I smoked a joint instead. Made it back into the room. Stayed sober for a little while. The back of Sunday Nighters. Stayed sober about a year. And 3 things happened. And the woman I was seeing, it turns out, was having a bit of an affair with a fine member of Alcoholics Anonymous who was about 12 years sober. So that sort of sucked. My sponsor at the time, I had made the mistake of going into business with. A little birdie whispered in my ears that check the books. Check the books, check the books. I didn't believe it. I checked the books. My sponsor had learned how to sign my name really well. Obviously, he was fired from being my sponsor. I wanted to kill him. Strike two for AA. The third thing, my loving family decided that 3 months sober would be a great time to tell me, by the way, your dad, who died when you were 2, well, you know, the guy you wrote deceased next to father's occupation for 30 years. Well, he's not really dead. He's alive and well, living in Los Angeles. Oh, fuck. Strike three. The way I saw it is that, boy, was I mad at AA. AA was comprised, and especially people with, like, between 10 and 20 years of sobriety, these people were scumbags. You know? Period. You know? And my mom, who was a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, may have skipped an amend or two in there. You know, oh, by the way, you know, this might have been covered in your fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh. Oops. So I didn't react well to this. Did I pick up a drink? No, I've learned not to pick up a drink by now. And people say, yo, this is AA, we're only going to talk about booze. Well, I've managed to pick up other substances every time I've gone out. Do I pick up a drink? No, I've learned not to pick up a goddamn drink. I'm going to try something else. This time it was Coke. And I didn't drink. Is it a slip? Of course it's a goddamn slip, even if you don't pick up a drink. You know? Because I was high as a kite. I had learned not to pick up a drink. And that that started a terrible 14 months. And I went from about 180 pounds down to 135 pounds and went insane. And was doing things like listening to the television, leaving the television on the horoscope channel with the sound off, you know, so I could hear if people were going to come break into the door. I'd stopped using my bedroom, so I was living on Saint Laurent Boulevard, and Saint Laurent, the bastards change where the garbage goes. Every 6 months, it either goes out in the front or it goes out in the back or whatever. I lost track. Garbage went in the bedroom. It stayed there. I opened the window in the winter so it stayed cool. The fridge, I never used, never cleaned out. It became a science project. People were warned not to go in there. Some people went in there. Too bad for them. And my poor pussycats, you know, really had a bad time because they ate about as often as I did, and their litter box got changed every couple of months or something. I mean, yeah, when I started tripping over the cat turds, it was probably time to... Poor guys. And unfortunately, I turned my will and my life over to the care of my cat. Because the cat was more sane than I was. And if the cat liked somebody, they were fine. If the cat didn't like them, they had to leave. You know? As simple as that. It was really, really very simple. And that's that. And after about 14 months of this, I was in tears all the time. And I was still mad at AA. But I came back. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I showed up. So the day I decided to come back to AA, off this terrible slip, half dead, happens to be the 50th anniversary of Monday Central. What a great place to take a newcomer's chip. Took the newcomer's chip and didn't know whether or not it would work. You know, because by this time, it may not work again. I also went to another 12-step program, figure out which one that was, you know, on the French side. I went to CA. Ooh, my God, you said another 12-step program's name. On the French side. And why did I do that? Really simple. Because I didn't know all the personalities. And because if you're dealing with stuff in another language, I can't just sit in the back. Every molecule of my concentration was required to understand somebody talking about the 12 steps, reading the traditions. All that crap was new. And they welcomed me, and they saved my life. And I spent the first 6 months there until I got over the resentment against AA. And I'd come over for an English meeting a couple of times a week, and I'd come back. And that was, God, that was 12 years ago. And had another good 10 years, you know, came very close to to getting a 10-year cake. And this time it was just negligence. Somebody said, here, have a puff of this. And at 9 years and 10 months sober, got stoned. That nonsense lasted exactly 3 weeks. After which I got down on my knees and I asked God to take it away. Because during the entire process of sobriety, the one thing that really came out that was very, very, very helpful and that has never changed is that I found a higher power that for some unknown reason gives a shit about me that I can ask for help. And it always arrives. I ask for help, it always comes. I often forget to ask for help, I often forget to deal with it. But when I ask God for help, it happens. And I was on my knees, I asked for help, poof, and things are okay. And I'm extremely lucky because you don't get too many chances like that. And I then had a problem. And this was an interesting problem because I was saying, well, you know, maybe this wasn't a slip. You know, this just a, you know, couple of puffs of pot, is that a slip? Well, I'll tell you how this crafty alcoholic dealt with that. It was really, really simple. I postponed the decision about whether or not it was a slip. Because I, you know, because what I was worried about, really simply, was that, listen, I was about to take a 10-year cake. And so I blew this 10 years of sobriety for this puff of dope. Well, hang on. Since I'm already on a slip, maybe I should do this right. Maybe I should have the mother of all slips here and really make it worthwhile. The little bit of me that was still sane was saying, that's not such a good idea because you're going to die. You know, your chances of dying are really good. So I postponed the decision of whether or not this was a slip. Got down on my knees, asked God to take it away. Stop. Then it took about 3 months before, you know, 3 months back sober. And then at that point I said, you know, I think that was a slip. Because, you know, gotten through the dangerous self-destruct phase, because I'm also convinced that most alcoholics, most of us in here, have the giant red self-destruct button that we can push at any time. Don't necessarily have to push it drinking. There are many, many other ways to push the button. And awfully lucky that there are people around to talk to, because something I've often heard, especially in the New York meetings, is you're only as sick as your secrets. Thank God. So, as long as somebody knows what's going on, that's great, because, you know, it's the dark crevices in my head where the weird stuff happens I don't talk about. And if I can dump that and talk about it, it's a whole lot better. So if you're new, or you're old, or you're coming back, it's a great place to be. Wonderful, wonderful place. I'm extraordinarily lucky. Spent the earlier part of this month on a trip to Florida and went down to Key West. And boy, there was a Sunday night meeting that was just like Sunday nighters. And felt right at home. And I took something back from there. They're giving out their newcomer chips the same way we give out newcomer chips here. And what they often say when they ask people to come up and get their chips is, do you want to give up the high cost of low living? And boy, I identify with that. So I'm awfully happy to be here. I'm not sure that this recording will make it up onto the Sunday Nighters website. There may be technical difficulties between the recorder and the machine. You know, there may be the Richard Nixon 14-minute blank spot. You know? And you guys have been really peaceful and quiet and nice. And if you're new, and you're in pain, have a chat with God. If you don't believe in God, have a chat with my higher power. You can borrow them. Ask for help. And you will be amazed at how quickly it comes. And it may not be in the form that you think it should arrive in. But it will arrive, like the cavalry. And stick around. It's a wonderful place. Thanks a lot.